I was going to get a quick show of hands. Who's seen the 2011 Oscar winner, The King's Speech? Anyone seen that? Yeah. Yep. Colin Firth. Some of you around my vintage might remember him as Mr. Darcy. Yeah? Okay. Some of you do. Some of you don't. Colin Firth won both an Oscar and the Golden Globe for his portrayal of King George VI. And at the Golden Globes, in his acceptance speech, he'd said something rather unusual. The actor said, as he accepted the Golden Globe award, that winning the award had saved him from buying a Harley Davidson. And everyone laughed. And that's because the Harley is the universal symbol of the male midlife crisis. Now, I'm turning 42 in a few weeks, and I sympathise. Anyone want to buy me a Harley out there? Just come and see me afterwards. How do we cope, though, with the reality that our waistlines are spreading, our hairlines are receding? Okay, some of us more than others. How do we cope with the unfulfilled ambitions in our lives? How do we cope with the fact that the second half of our lives is well underway, not just starting, but well underway? How do we cope with the realization that either we're never going to make it to the top, or if we've made it to the top, it's not all that's cracked up to be? Well, what happens we see in celebrities, and some of you sadly might see it in people you know, is that we start behaving like little boys again, buying ridiculously large motorbikes. I don't know if I can even ride a Harley Davidson, to be honest. We spend money on expensive toys. We get odd piercings, all right? Or we even develop kind of crushes on much younger women. According to Colin Firth, his Golden Globe has saved him from all of that. But King Nebuchadnezzar, we see today, wasn't so lucky. At one level, King Nebuchadnezzar was very successful. If you remember from last week, actually, there's another Oscar winner, director of Titanic, James Cameron, famously said he's the king of the world. Well, Nebuchadnezzar actually was the king of the known world. We saw and met him last week that he conquered all before him. He had reached the top of the game. There was just nothing else left for him to do. He had absolute power. He had the biggest army in the world. He could have anything he wanted. And so for all intents and purposes, he had made it. But all was not well. Easy having a midlife crisis. Well, he was having bad dreams. We know that. And chapter 2 starts with these words. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. Despite all that he had going for him, something was wrong. Please keep your Bibles open and your outline. It's fairly straightforward. I'll keep to that, and that'll help you know where I'm going and where I am. This, as you heard Fiona read before, is a long chapter, but the storyline, it's not too hard to follow, is it? Here's what happens. You see it up there on your screen. Hopefully that's legible there. Basically, Nebuchadnezzar gets agitated in the first 13 verses. Daniel then gets involved. The dream gets explained to Neb. Okay, and then Nebuchadnezzar gets religious and Daniel gets promoted. All right, that's kind of the flow of the story. So first of all, Nebuchadnezzar gets very, very antsy. It seems from verse 2 that this wasn't just a single bad dream, but this actually went on night after night. He was getting very, very tired and very, very grumpy. So he called in the magicians, the sorcerers, the enchanters, and the astrologers. Now, it's hard to really kind of pinpoint and give very specific job descriptions for who these guys were. But basically, their role was to work out the omens, what the gods were saying to them. And how do they do it? Well, they had lots of books which told them, you know, if a cow had an abnormal kind of birth of a calf, if there was unusual events in the sky. We know they documented one of the supernovas that happened in their time. The shape of animal intestines they might cut open and lay out. And of course, dreams, when people had dreams, what those dreams meant. These men were the forerunners of the Magi that we hear about in the New Testament, who 600 years later would travel from Iraq, you know, that's where they are, present-day Iraq, to Judea to find the baby King Jesus. Now, As the story rolls on, though, it seems that Nebuchadnezzar has already had some issues with these future consultants. When they give him their usual spiel, in verse 4, read it with me, then the astrologers answer the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we will interpret it." Nebuchadnezzar puts in a twist. In verse 5, he says, "This is what I have firmly decided." Now, you're not going to change my mind on this. "If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turn into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you'll receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me." See, Neb refuses to tell them the content of his dreams. And so the wise men say, "You can't be serious. Just tell us the dream and we'll give you our take on it." But they realize in verses 8 and 9 that the king is actually being really serious. They start to realize this king's dream is rapidly turning into a nightmare for them. And so this is the best they could come up with. Verse 10, the astrologers answer the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans." During Bible college, Becca was a part of Women's Chapel, and she heard a lady preach on this very passage, and she did some really, really interesting homework in preparation. She rang up the psychic hotline, as you do, and then proceeded to do a Nebuchadnezzar on them. So this is my kind of rendition of how the conversation would have gone, right? The psychic answers the phone. "Welcome to Madam..." Sorry, I'm sounding a bit draggy there. Sorry, that's... Just go with it, okay? So just imagine I'm a woman. "Welcome to Madam So-and-so's psychic hotline. Would you tell me your dreams and I'll tell you what it means for your future?" Actually, I want to know that you're a genuine psychic, right? That means you can read minds or you know the future. All right, so why don't you start by telling me what the dream I had? "Well, for Madame so-and-so to give you an interpretation of the future, I need to know your dreams." No. You don't get to play that game on me. Just tell me what my dream is and I'll believe the rest of what you say." "Look, Dale, that's not the way it works, all right? You got to tell me your dream and then I'll tell you what it means." And just like that, these so-called sorcerers and wise men and prophets, and they have been caught out. They've been exposed. They admit that they don't have any real power, any real connection with the divine, any real vision of the future. So they throw it back on Nebuchadnezzar. "You're asking too much, O king." And that wasn't the wisest thing to do for these wise men, is it? Like to say to this agitated dictator. So this first part of the story ends with this in verse 12. "This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. And men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death." So when the execution squad comes looking for Daniel, he gets involved, him and his friends. Remember from last week, they're strangers in a strange land. They've been put through the University of Babylon. They've graduated with university medals. Do they give multiples of them out? Sorry, I don't know. I've never gotten one of those. So anyway, and now they're in the public service as a wise man himself. And he wisely takes the initiative with the king when the death squad comes looking for him. He secures a little bit of time in order to work out what to do without just fobbing the king off. And then, interestingly, he doesn't go to the library. He doesn't go and find a cow to cut up. He goes home and he goes to his friends. He asks Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to plead for mercy from the God of heaven so they wouldn't be executed. Now, notice this is kind of not anything super spiritual about this request for prayer. He says, "Pray so that we don't have our heads cut off." But Daniel also is very clear about the fact that they don't deserve God's help at all. He speaks with real humility here, if you read those verses. He asks them to ask God for mercy, which is a massive contrast with Nebuchadnezzar's presumption that the wise men will just kind of be kind of, you know, all over this. They'll just be masters of all that has to happen. You see, for Daniel, wisdom comes from God, by the mercy and the grace of God. And hold that thought. We'll get to that in a bit of time. And so sure enough, during the night, God shows Daniel what he needed to know. And in verses 24 to 45, the dream gets explained. Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar the contents of his own dream. This is very, very impressive, particularly if you, like me, are one of those people who have trouble remembering your own dreams, let alone remembering someone else's dreams. But God shows Daniel every tiny detail of Neb's dreams. It's of this enormous statue made of gold, silver, bronze, and iron mixed with clay, which is smashed by a rock, which then grew to the size of a mountain and filled up the whole world. So what's this all about? Well, this is where we have to be a little bit careful. Over the years, many, many people have spilt, you know, oceans of ink and cut down forests of trees to try and elaborate on what this means, and they kind of come out with schemes, identify varying bits of the statue with, you know, the Medes, the Persian Empire, the Greeks, the Romans, and so on. But actually, Daniel doesn't say any of that. We'll get onto some of that sort of stuff in later talks. But basically, the principle is, if it's important, the Bible's going to tell you. Okay? If it's important, the Bible's going to tell you. So the Bible here just says that Nebuchadnezzar is the golden head, which, yeah, it's an idea the king obviously liked, with the implication that his kingdom, just like any other human kingdom before him and any other kingdom to come, well, after him, it's going to be downhill. Until, that is, God sets up, in verse 44, a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And Nebuchadnezzar's response to all this is pretty dramatic too. I guess, you know, you just wonder whether he actually expected anyone to be able to do what he's asked to come up with his dream. And here is Daniel. He's come up with not only the dream, but its interpretation. So have a read of his response. So you're going to have to probably flip over the page to 46, right at the end of the passage. Then Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of mysteries, for you are able to reveal this mystery." Basically, Nebuchadnezzar gets religious. Before we get too excited that we might have a new convert here, we shouldn't read too much into what he says. As a good Babylonian, Nebuchadnezzar believes in all kinds of gods. All right, so what he does now is really make room for another one on his shelf. He's so pleased, in fact, he even goes as far as to say Daniel's God is the top of the ladder, all right, in the God League. You know, NRL, National Rugby League, this would be National God League, NGL for him. God, Yahweh God, is now on the top. And it's a long way off from saying that Daniel's God is the one and true living God. What Neb's dream really told him is that everything might be golden for him right now, but no human kingdom, if you like, carved out by human effort and blood and sweat and tears, no human kingdom has ever lasted. And his won't either. But God's kingdom, not carved by human hands, that will last forever. Because, point two, and these points get shorter now, there's no kingdom like God's kingdom. As we take a step back from this story, which we've kind of just raced through here to pick up the highlights package, the world, if you think about it, can be a very scary place, can't it? Just yesterday, it was reported on ABC that North Korea has resumed their missile testing program again, as talks between the leaders broke down a couple of months ago. We're in election time, all right, and we're about to vote on our federal government. As we're doing that, we're hearing reports from America that they're kind of trying to deal with Russian interference, still from their last presidential elections a couple of years ago. Goodness knows who's at work interfering with our current election. playing Cambridge and Analytica with our Facebook feeds? And would it even matter if, say, a superpower like China ever decided to put the largest active military force in the world to use in our region? And that's just the external stuff, isn't it? Come back next week, because I want to actually talk about some of the internal pressures that you might be feeling as well. In the week where we see Christians under so much pressure, right, for their faith. Yes, whether they expressed it the way that you want them to, or that was wise to in social media and things like that, that's causing them so much trouble now. Like, all that's by the by. There's so much internal pressure. I was, during the week, just kind of taking a wedding. Ben, I'll get you to do something unusual. Can you just pause the recording here? The where Daniel puts us, as we kind of look out across the vista of the world and the international stage of, you can feel very small, can't you? Australia, yes, big island continent, but very, very small in terms of influence. You see, God is actually wanting us to remember that human kingdoms, they rise and they fall. Empires like the USSR, the greatest area that in modern times of any single political power, those regimes, they come and they go. None of them last. You see, the Babylonians, they don't last. 70 short years later, they'll be gone. Saddam Hussein, who incidentally styled his regime on that of Nebuchadnezzar. Do you remember during the Gulf War, he said the mother of all battles will come, or something like that? All right, I only just realized recently he's actually trying to draw on some of the language of what Nebuchadnezzar and the religion of those, the pagan religion of those times would. That's a good Muslim right there, isn't it? The Greeks that came after the Babylonians, they didn't last. The Persians, sorry. The Romans, they didn't last. Even the lifetime of some of us, we've seen the National Socialists in Germany, the Nazis, they didn't last. The Communist Eastern Bloc, USSR and all the satellite states, they didn't last. Khmer Rouge, they didn't last. All right, we've seen the Idi Amins and the Chairman Mao's and Kim Jong-il's. They didn't last. These empires, these powers, these beastly kingdoms, they rise and they fall. It's always the way. And that's because there's no kingdom like God's kingdom. This is what Daniel says about this kingdom. It's worthwhile to read it again. Verse 44. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands, a rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. See, Daniel is catching a vision of a day when God would act decisively. When he would send this rock, his rock, to set up this kingdom. And even though the superpowers of the world might try and crush this rock, there can only be one outcome, that they will be the ones that are crushed. And this rock is Jesus, the King of the Kingdom of God. All the way through the Old Testament, God says that he will do something dramatic and lasting and world-changing. He will send his king to set up his kingdom. This king will be opposed, but he will not be defeated. See, that's why Jesus himself referred to this very passage at the end of the parable of the tenants in Matthew 21. I'll flash it up on the screen there. It says, Jesus said to them, "Have you never read the scriptures? The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. The Lord has done this and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore I tell you that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you." He's talking to Jews here and the Jewish leaders particularly. "And given to a people who will produce its fruits." He's talking about Christians. "He will fall upon this stone. He who falls upon this stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed." God's kingdom will prevail. God's kingdom is the one that will last. And God's kingdom will triumph against all earthly opposition. Why is Daniel 2? Why is Matthew 21? Why are those passages there for us? I think we really need parts of these parts of the Bible, because they stop us from going underground. They stop us slipping into thinking that our faith is basically a private matter. They stop us from trying to fly under the radar, that it's thinking that it's all about Jesus and me, a personal thing that is helpful to me but isn't necessary for other people. You see, the God of the Bible won't be reduced to being just our personal sponsor. He's the God of gods and the Lord of lords. He's the king who rules over the ultimate kingdom. And he's the God who loves us, but who also says that either we worship him, either humans worship him or be crushed by him. Either we fall before him willingly or because we've been brought to our knees. So friends, don't make the mistake of thinking that just because Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar saw this in a dream, that this is all symbolic. This is reality. God has already set up this kingdom, and it will grow and grow until one day when Christ winds up history, we will all have to stand before Jesus. We will all have to stand before the rock. We will all have to stand to face this reality. This is terribly serious stuff, and this calls for wisdom. The sort of wisdom that only God can give. Because point three, there's no wisdom like God's wisdom. So diving back into the story there, you see, Nebuchadnezzar's dream team of advisors, with all their combined wisdom and all their massive collection of books, they still couldn't come up with the information, could they, that Nebuchadnezzar needed to put his mind at ease. Only God could do that. And the message of the story, there's no wisdom like God's wisdom. I hope you can see that this chapter actually really isn't about Daniel and his wisdom. You see, Daniel himself says the very same thing. He says it's all about God. Look with me, if you will, at Daniel's prayer back in verse 20. He says, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king." Daniel leaves us in absolutely no doubt that any wisdom he has shown has really come from the God of wisdom. That throughout this process, yes, he's shown real wisdom. He's tactful in verse 14, takes initiative in verse 15. He's humble, acknowledging there's nothing that he can do to sort this out, verse 18. And he's deeply thankful when God actually eventually answers his prayer, verse 20. But at every stage, Daniel insists that this is all actually down to God. And you can see it there in verses 27 when he finally speaks to the king and explains, before he goes and explains the dream, where this all come from. Verse 27, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery that he has asked about." And jumping, and in verse 30 later on, he says, "including me." I'm not one of those guys who could, of my own ability, do that. Verse 28, "But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. It is him. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come." And even Nebuchadnezzar recognizes in verse 47 that this isn't because Daniel is some outstanding individual. It's because Daniel belongs to an outstanding God. And this chapter of Daniel really picks up an important theme in the Old Testament. And God makes it really clear. He himself, he alone, is the source of wisdom. And he wants to share this wisdom with us. And real wisdom in the Bible starts with knowing God himself. It isn't so much a lesson to be learned as a relationship to be enjoyed. The Babylonians, they needed to understand that you can't get wisdom from books or reading animal guts, for that matter, but only from a conversation with God. As the book of Proverbs sums it up, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Doug O'Donnell, who spoke at our teaching weekend a few years ago, he's got the best definition, I reckon, of the fear of the Lord. What's the fear of the Lord? The fear of the Lord is a continual, humble, and faithful submission to Yahweh. See how relational those words are, the categories, which compels us to hate evil and turn away from it and bring with it rewards better than all earthly treasures, a love for and knowledge of God and long life, confidence, satisfaction and protection. How do you be wise? How do you wise up? How do you respond correctly to the God whose kingdom is irresistible and eternal? The Old Testament answer is fear the Lord. The real wisdom only comes through a relationship with God. And in the New Testament, this wisdom comes in a person. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22, Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for their kind of human wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and here it is, the wisdom of God. It is because of God himself, that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us now wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. What's Paul saying? He's saying, if you really want to get wise, if you want real wisdom, you need Jesus. Only he can restore you to a right relationship with God. Only he can actually make us think and act like God. That's what being godly means. Only he can rescue us from being, to be part of God's family. If we want to find God's wisdom, there's only one place to look. There's only one person who can give us the wisdom that we need. Only this Jesus can put us in the right mindset when we're most fearful about the world. Only this Jesus can put us in the right mindset when we're most discontent in our midlife crises. Only this Jesus can put us in the right mindset when we're most disappointed with our relationships. If we want to be wise, then we need to start looking at the world in the light of who Jesus is and what he has done. Jesus, the King of God's irresistible kingdom, who for our sakes was crucified. He has become for us wisdom from God. If we want to make sense of our world, if we want to live well, if we want to live wisely, we actually need to live by faith in Jesus. So at the end of the day, the message from chapter 2 of Daniel is actually pretty simple. This week, what do we need to do? We need to do two things. First of all, we need to remember that there is no wisdom like God's wisdom, and it begins with trusting Jesus and looking to him for the wisdom we need. And secondly, we need to remember that there is no kingdom like God's kingdom, that we bow before him, our God and our King. As Daniel prays, praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his, and his alone.